From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we learn how Milwaukee could play a big role in who becomes the next president of the United States. Then we chat with the author of The Giver about how her books are helping kids navigate today's world.
Books of the sort that I write do play the role of presenting the questions and making them available to kids for discussion.
Plus, contributor Joanne Nelson joins us to talk about her new memoir, This Is How We Leave.
If I could sum it up in one word, I think it would be resiliency. And I think what I would like people to take away is that there are a lot of ways to turn out and to get through hard times and come out positive and use that past to help others.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As we inch closer to the election, the importance of Milwaukee voters is becoming more and more clear. It's the largest city in Wisconsin and home to a large portion of the state's minority populations. In 2016, when Hillary Clinton was running against then-presidential candidate Donald Trump, she was criticized for not stepping foot in Wisconsin. Joe Biden's campaign has visited the state, and vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris has visited the city. But Biden himself has yet to hold an event in Milwaukee. While Milwaukee generally goes blue on Election Day, there are no guarantees in an election taking place during a pandemic. Sam Levine covers voting rights for The Guardian, an online international news publication. He recently wrote a paper looking at why Milwaukee could determine Joe Biden's fate in the November election. Levine spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about voting barriers and how this year compares to the 2016 presidential election.
To start with, why do you think Milwaukee will play such a big role in the November election?
Well, there's no question that Milwaukee is going to be incredibly important in the November election. It's the biggest city in Wisconsin, and it's also home to a significant portion of the state's minority population. There's no question that Joe Biden will likely win Milwaukee. It's a Democratic bastion. It's a crucial part of what any Democratic candidate needs to win the state. But what makes it really important this election cycle is that in 2016, there was a really severe drop in turnout. There were about 41,000 fewer voters who turned out to vote in 2016 than did in 2012. And overcoming that drop and making sure that that doesn't happen again is going to be really, really important to determining whether or not Biden can win in the state.
How do you think voter turnout will differ this year compared to 2016?
I think all the signs are pointing towards very high voter turnout. People are requesting mail-in ballots like never before, and there's clearly enthusiasm to vote this year. I think there are a couple factors that are complicating that, though. One big question is voter registration. People haven't been able to conduct voter registration drives, canvass, knock on doors, get people signed up to vote the way that they have been in the past. In Wisconsin, that's a little more complicated because in Wisconsin, you can register at the polls on Election Day, which is considered a very positive step towards expanding the right to vote. But it's unclear how many people are going to feel safe and comfortable turning out at the polls in person. So I think that's one big question is voter registration. The second is how many people are going to be familiar with the rules around what they need to do to vote. Are they going to know how to request an absentee ballot, how to fill out an absentee ballot, and all the requirements that come with that? In Wisconsin, you have to submit a picture of your voter ID. You have to get it witnessed. And those are all unfamiliar for a lot of people. Wisconsin is not a state where there's been a ton of mail-in balloting before. So I think those are all factors that could complicate turnout this election. There are also government offices have been closed, so people who haven't voted before and might need an ID, it's much harder for them to get one. Students might be at home rather than at school and might not have access to get an absentee ballot. They might not be engaging with campus voter registration drives the way they would have under normal circumstances. So I think there's a lot of signs of high turnout, of a lot of enthusiasm, but there are severe and really unique obstacles that we haven't seen before that could challenge that.
How does higher voter turnout influence the outcome of the election? Does it help one party over the other?
I think that there isn't a clear partisan breakdown on this. I think in recent years, we've seen kind of this reflexive attitude among the parties, particularly in the Republican Party, that anything that allows more people to vote and makes it easier for people to vote is going to hurt the Republican Party. And we've seen that play out, that kind of reflexive thinking play out when it comes to voting by mail. Republicans have, for the most part, really opposed efforts to make it easier to vote by mail this year. And the research hasn't really shown that that's true. There are plenty of Republican voters who vote by mail, who senior citizens, military voters, who don't want to appear in person. And in a lot of states, voting by mail has been a really important part of Republican strategy for getting out the vote for years. But we've really arrived at this place here in 2020 where there's this kind of partisan thinking around voting that the more people who vote, the worse it's going to be for the Republican Party. And that kind of thinking has really shaped a lot of the high stakes debates around this that we've seen over the last few years.
In your article, you call out Republican crafted barriers to voting. Why would that be so advantageous for their party?
I think there's a sense that minority groups, younger voters, students, all tend to support Democrats. And there has been research shown that things that make it harder to vote impact those groups. They might be less likely to have an ID. They might be less likely to be able to vote on election day as opposed to voting early and things like that. And I think across the country, what we're seeing is a changing electorate, changing demographics, and an effort on the part of the Republican Party to freeze out that kind of new electorate, the changing demographics, to make it so that instead of expanding the numbers of voters that they're bringing into their party, to freeze out new voters who could support the other party. So I think that's kind of the thinking around that.
It seems like it wouldn't be advantageous to write off such large sections of the electorate rather than trying to expand, your voting base. Why do you think that that's done?
You have to take a step back and look at the kind of policy positions that the Republican Party has taken on really, in the last few years. This is a party that has really taken an anti-immigration stance, for example. It is not making efforts to bring in Latino and Hispanic voters. And the more kind of dug in you get on those stances, the more kind of you try to play to your base, the people that you know are likely to support you, the harder it is to bring in new voters. And so you start doing things, I think, to protect that kind of core base of people that support you. And I think what a lot of voters I talked to for this recent piece I wrote about Milwaukee is just assuming that voters are going to vote a certain way because they are a minority or because they're part of any other group is really a mistake. That it's really a mistake to just kind of reflexively take the political leanings of any group for granted.
What does it signal or mean for the country if voter suppression is associated with one of the two political parties, but those efforts are still able to continue?
I think it's a really dangerous position for the country. The foundation of power in America is this idea that our leaders are chosen. They govern through the consent of the people. And when we start choosing people based on the votes of not everyone, but just a smaller group, that really starts to bring in questions about the legitimacy of the power that they wield. And when people start to feel like it won't matter how they vote, it doesn't matter what candidates they support or what policies they want, it's not going to be reflected in who's in office, we start having a government, I think, that's really far removed from the will of the people, from the voice of the people, and one that really doesn't reflect who we are, and I think most dangerously, that we don't see as legitimate. And when we start not seeing our government as a legitimate one, it raises all kinds of really dangerous questions about the way that laws are made, the way that policies are made. And it seems like we're going down that road where there are questions about the legitimacy of people who are elected and the kinds of things that they're able to do while in office. So I think it's a really kind of dangerous position for the country to be in.
With the pandemic limiting or changing hours and services at the Department of Motor Vehicles in Milwaukee, how do you think the voter ID law will affect voters?
I think it's going to be a huge challenge still. This was something that the 2016 presidential election was the first presidential election in Wisconsin where this was in effect. And just talking to activists and election officials there was tremendous confusion about this new law. It was tied up in the courts. It was kind of going back and forth. People didn't know the exact requirements that they had to meet. There was kind of a half-hearted effort by the state to run a PSA campaign about it. There was still a lot of confusion. So I think now, here we are 4 years later, people maybe have gotten a little more used to it. They've gotten more familiar with it. But they still don't have access to state offices to get the IDs they need or documents that they need. They might not, just because of the harshness of the economic conditions with the pandemic, might not have a chance to get there and take off the time of work. So I think that it's still going to remain a huge, huge barrier, and that the pandemic has only exacerbated the obstacles that people face.
And how do you think the vote will be suppressed in the general election? And how do you think those efforts have changed since 2016?
I think some of what we're going to see this fall is similar to what we saw in 2016. Voter ID in Wisconsin will still be a huge issue and a huge obstacle for a lot of people. There are also cuts to early voting that are going to happen in Wisconsin this year. I think there are only 2 weeks. The state can only offer 2 weeks of early voting, which is a severe cutback from what localities have been able to offer in the past. And that's going to make it, that just means voters will have much less time to go to the polls and cast their votes. Because many people are voting by mail for the first time, I think there are going to be a whole new, there are a ton of ways that people can have their ballots rejected by mail that don't apply if you vote in person. If you forget to get someone to witness your ballot in Wisconsin, it can be rejected. If you forget to sign, if you forget to date it, if it gets to an election office too late to be counted, your ballot can be rejected. And I think we're going to see tons of fighting around that in the lead up to the election and even after the election. And I think there's also just going to be this effort to from the president and from people who support him, creating this narrative that the election is rigged, that no matter how you vote, it's already been predestined how the election is going to turn out. And that decreases people's confidence in the election results, but I think it also decreases the motivation that people have to go to the polls. If you hear that something is rigged, that it's not going to matter, then you think, okay, well, why should I take the time to go through this whole process to vote? Doesn't matter how my one vote isn't going to make a difference. So I think that's really dangerous as well.
Is there anything else you're paying special close attention to?
I think one thing that's going to be really unique this year that we have never seen in the past is that we're really unlikely to know the winner of the presidential election on Election Day. Americans are used to this tradition where you have Election Day, you have the TV anchors on election night who call the result, the loser comes out and gives a concession, and then the president or the president-elect will come out and give their victory speech. We're used to that ritual. But because there's more mail-in voting, it's going to take much longer for election officials to process the ballots. In some states, including Wisconsin, election officials can't even begin to process the ballots by law until Election Day. And they're going to have millions of ballots to verify and count and process. And that process is just going to take a few days. And there's a lot of concern about what could happen in that uncertain period after Election Day when America is just waiting and there's this uncertainty. The president has made it very clear that he expects there to be an election result on Election Day and has suggested that any ballots that are counted afterwards are illegitimate or fraudulent, which is just not true. These are legitimate ballots that election officials are still going to be counting. So people are thinking about what happens if the president claims victory in the presidential race before all the ballots are counted. What happens if it appears that one candidate is ahead on election night, but the ballot totals shift as more are counted? How do we prepare the public for accepting that possibility, for understanding that that is a normal process? And the worst case scenario I think that could really evolve into is a scenario when it comes time for the Electoral College to meet and there's still uncertainty over who has won a state and who has which slate of electors has the legitimacy when it comes to the Electoral College. And the laws around what happens if that's the case, if there's a conflict, are really, really unclear. And if we got to that point, it would be a really dangerous situation that would really be kind of unprecedented in our history. And so I'm not willing to say that that's definitely going to happen, but that's kind of a worst case scenario. But I think the thing that I'm paying definitely the most attention to is, how do we handle this period of uncertainty and waiting after Election Day that could determine who the next president is going to be?
Sam Levine covers voting rights for The Guardian, an online international news publication. He spoke with Lakefect's Becca Schimmel about his recent article, Why Milwaukee Could Determine Joe Biden's Fate in the November Election. Coming up next, we'll speak with Lois Lowry, author of the classic novel The Giver. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This past year has been extraordinary in so many ways. The pandemic, the recession, and the impending election have created an endless news cycle that at times seems surreal, like something out of a book. For author Lois Lowry, this moment in history is oddly reminiscent of her own work, like The Giver, a young adult dystopian novel which explores a world that prizes conformity above all else. Or Number the Stars. That's a novel set in Nazi-occupied Denmark and tells the story of a Jewish family forced to escape their home due to their political persecution. But while the topic of her books is often dark, Lowry says she believes in happy endings, which is perhaps why she's joining the First Unitarian Society of Milwaukee to give a lecture titled Dwelling in Possibility. Before the event this Saturday, Lowry joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about this historical moment and her work.
This last year has been, I think, very interesting, to say the least. As a writer who really deals in, you know, complex themes, especially for a young audience, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this moment that we're living through right now. Do you see parallels between your work and this moment in history?
Oh, boy, that's a complex question, and I'm going to give you a lot of credit for dreaming it up. Whether I can come up with a complex answer, I don't know. I will say that you're of course, right. This has been a very different, unusual, and difficult year. As a writer, though, as a person who is a writer, I am accustomed to isolation. I'm a very solitary person who spends my time sitting alone in a room, putting words on, used to be a piece of paper, of course, now it's into a computer. So my life has not, in that regard, changed very much. But I write for young people, and I hear from young people, and I have grandchildren, and I'm aware of how their lives have changed and what a loss this has brought to them in terms of their relationship to other people. My life when I was a teenager and my grandchildren's lives, now they're in college, consist of their relationships with friends, romantic relationships at a time, of course, when I was a teenager, that was true, and still is today. And now they're so alone and solitary. And so that's been a tremendous adjustment for them. And I think that will affect them for years to come. As I say, my life has not changed that much, except I will say my husband came down with COVID. He went off in an ambulance from our house on April 4th, and I was not able to see him again until he was released from the hospital on June 24th. And I haven't added it up, but that's about 10 weeks. And I could talk to him on the phone, but often he was very difficult to understand because he was so ill and so drugged. So that was a particularly horrible period of time for me. He's now home and he's recovering, but it's a long, slow recovery with a lot of after effects. So in that regard, that's something that has affected me and will continue to. But as I was saying, it's the young people that I care about. I'm 83 and my husband's 88. He will be next month. So we're not going to be around that much longer, but it's the kids. My grandchildren that I worry about, what is their future going to be like? And of course, this is a very difficult time politically as well, and I shouldn't take a political stance on public radio. But I will say this, whatever your political views are, this is a very stressful and difficult time, and that's going to have an effect for years to come, long after I'm gone. So I worry about that too. I spend an inordinate amount of time worrying about teenagers, even though I am no longer one, and my kids are grown, and even my youngest grandchild is now 19. But it's those younger ones, the ones who are 11, 12, and 13, that I worry about in such a formative time of their lives in a world that has just kind of fallen apart in so many ways. I just hope it gets put back together in ways that will be beneficial to these kids.
First, I'd like to say I'm so sorry to hear about your husband, but I'm glad that he's on the road to recovery.
He lost 30 pounds. I wish it had been me that had lost 30 pounds. But yes, he's getting better slowly.
Good. You know, looking at especially that age range that you're talking about, younger teens, one of the big themes of your books, specifically The Giver, is this idea of being the same as one another, which is a really interesting concept to explore right now because our country is so divided in many ways, as you yourself just, you know, alluded to. Has this idea of conformity become more potent in a culture where our differences are so divisive?
Gosh, and I that's an unanswerable question. I don't know the answer to it, but I think back to my own years of being in that formative time of 11, 12, 13, when you're trying to figure out who you are and who you're going to be, trying to separate from your parents without being alienated from them, and trying to find your place in the world of your peers. And of course, you're quite right that that kids of that age work so hard at being the same as their peers, at the same time that they need to find their own individuality. Whatever the circumstances are in the larger world, I think this is always the thing with kids. But nowadays, of course, they're isolated from their peers. And also something that did not exist in my adolescence, thank goodness I think now, is, how can I describe it in one word, the media. There were no computers when I was young. There was no internet. So there was none of that immediate access that is so much a part of the lives of our kids now. And in some ways, it makes their lives better at the same time that it has a certain corrupting influence, I'm afraid. We've got so many things to work out in this country, in this world. And, you know, for me, my role in it is the writer of books, presenting these issues to kids without pretending to be able to answer them. But I think books of the sort that I write do play the role of presenting the questions and making them available to kids for discussion. And even in today's school situation, where a lot of their education is taking place virtually, still teachers are using books like mine and others to present these issues and to initiate discussions with kids. I hear from teachers all the time, again, by the internet, by email, and they tell me about the interesting, particularly the book The Giver. It's often used in schools in 7th and 8th grade. I just had an email from a teacher who was kind of pissed off because she's 6th grade. She had always used The Giver, and this year her school has decided to use it in 7th grade, and she doesn't get to teach it. But she talked about what a wonderful vehicle it was for thought and for discussion and debate. And those are things that it's hard to initiate with kids at that age. They want to be in agreement with all their friends, and then they're presented with these issues where they're up for discussion. And teachers love having a vehicle like that. And I'm very honored always to hear that I've been able to provide that.
I will say that was about the age that I was when I read The Giver. I was about 6th or 7th grade. When you look at the moment in history that we are experiencing, which of your books would you say resonates most with this moment?
Which of my books?
Yes.
I suppose I would have to say The Giver, because it deals with a time in the not terribly distant future when the world has changed. And of course, we're at a time when the world is changing. The Giver is one of a quartet of books, and there are three that follow it. One of those four books, the second one called Gathering Blue, is also set in the same future time, but in a different location. In The Giver, the community where the boy lives is very sophisticated in terms of its technology. But in the second book, in a different location, they've lost all their technology. That book is called Gathering Blue. Live in a very primitive fashion. And each year, they're required to listen to a recitation of the history of their world. And in that ceremony, it's described an occasion when tall buildings fell and burned. And it's clearly a representation of 9/11. And yet the astonishing thing is that the book was written before that happened, which gives me a weird feeling of being prescient in some way. Then in the third book, same time period, different community, a very pleasant place where everybody gets along, and it's made up largely of immigrants, people who have come there from other places. And in that book, the community divides and factions are formed because one group wants to build a wall to keep out any further immigration. So again, it's oddly related to things that are happening now, though it was written a number of years ago. So any of these books, are related to what's happening now. And at the same time, there's another book I've written that is not as well known, and it's called Like the Willow Tree. And that's a book that is part of a series published by Scholastic called the Dear America series. I was asked to write this book, and each of those books, written by different authors, is in the voice of a child who is on the periphery of some historic event in this country. And so I was asked to write about the flu epidemic of 1918. I wrote this book probably, 10 years ago. And they've just decided to republish it with a new cover on it because, of course, I did a lot of research to write the book, but so much of what happened is being echoed now. At that time, and in the voice of the child talking about her family, her father's angry because people are closing down their stores. He is still going to work every day, but he thinks it's foolish that people are not going to work. And she's upset because her birthday's coming up, and she'd been told that she could go to the movies for her birthday. And movies, of course, were a big deal in 1918, very new. And so she was excited about that. But now the movie theaters are closed down. And so everybody's life is affected in the same ways that they're affected now. And of course, there's tragedy involved as well. So a number of my books, whatever form they take, are oddly related to these times. But I think of all of them, probably The Giver would be the one that is most related. And it in part has to do, the thing that kids take away from it is the fact that this world of the future has been created by people who, in making, I suppose, political decisions, had made compromises and had compromised on important things with a bad outcome. And so it alerts kids to the importance of decisions and political decisions. And peripherally then, of course, I hope it alerts them to the importance of voting, which is such an issue right now.
The speech that you'll be giving virtually here in Milwaukee is really all about hope and possibility. What does that mean to you? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I interrupted you. I'm sorry. But even though we deal with such difficult issues, I have always been a writer who looked for, at the end of a book, a happy ending. The Giver ends ambiguously. And you don't know when you finish reading it whether the boy, the protagonist, is alive or dead. But if you read the further books, you'll find that he's alive. I've always believed in happy endings. And even now, in these difficult times, I do think we'll come through it, because we always do. I hope we'll come through it stronger and better. But part of what I try to write about is resilience, that we need to hang in there, fight for what's right, and come through with a positive ending on the other side.
For you, what are some of the things that you've been focusing on right now, looking at what's possible and moving forward from that point?
Well, I have to think. It's curious because I'm working on a new book right now, and it's set in a distant previous time period. A lot of research involved, but I've been living in that time period instead of this one, and maybe that's a kind of denial and avoidance because it's so difficult to be in this time period. But I think, in answer to your question, the thing that I would focus on and that I hope kids are going to be able to is getting through it and maintaining optimism. That's the hard part sometimes, I think. It's so easy to just fall into despair and think this will never end. And yet, of course, it will. The book set in 1918 makes that clear. The book transpires over the course of a year. And of course, that epidemic ended eventually. It ended and left a lot of tragedy behind, as this is, but it did end. And so I think that's the thing to focus on, that there will be an ending, a resolution, a moving forward. And so I think optimism is what I try to focus on and to give to kids.
Well, Lois Lowry, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Okay, I'm really looking forward to, I was looking forward to being in Milwaukee. And now, of course, I'm not going to be, but I feel as though I am, because I'll be with people. And I've been doing a lot of these virtual events, and you can convince yourself that you're there in that crowd of little rectangles with faces. And so I'm looking forward to my time with Milwaukee.
Well, we're looking forward to having you.
Thank you.
Lois Lowry is an author best known for her books The Giver and Number the Stars, for which she won the Newbery Medal. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Coming up next, Joanne Nelson joins us to talk about her new memoir, This Is How We Leave. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. You may have heard contributor Joanne Nelson's essays on Lake Effect before. For Nelson, writing has always been a way not to just escape, but process things in her life. Her new memoir, This Is How We Leave, is a collection of essays that span Nelson's life, from her Milwaukee working-class Catholic school upbringing to building her own family while juggling her past. Amidst the background of a family filled with abandonment, disruption, emotional abuse, and alcoholism, Nelson walks readers through her life's memories with detail, humor, and empathy. She joins me now to share more about her new memoir. Joanne Nelson, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So this is the first time we've had a bit of a different format. Normally our listeners hear your essays and commentaries, but this time around, we're here to talk about your new memoir, This Is How We Leave. So before we get into the content of this book, I'm wondering, when did writing become a tool or a form of release for you?
That's such a wonderful question. I think when I was young, I remember in second grade getting some praise for a story. I think it was about some kids who got stuck in a drainage pipe. Clearly, since I remember that, it must have been important. But so I got this nice attention and I liked it. So throughout my life, there's been periods of a lot of writing, periods of not writing. I think in terms of an outlet, I've always journaled, and I even remember specifically in college journaling a lot to try and figure out what I was feeling and what I was doing.
So this book, This Is How We Leave, is a memoir, and it's a collection of essays. So how did this come together? I know you've always been writing, and you have maybe single pieces or commentaries, and these all kind of weave together throughout a timeline. So did you see that your essay collection kept growing and then realize like, hey, I can make this work and transform this into a book?
Mm-hmm. I did see it as an essay collection. And when I submitted it to Vine Leaves Press and they wrote me a letter of offer, in that letter, they said they saw it more as a memoir than a collection of essays. And they wrote me such a thorough letter all about the book that I was so curious about their view of it that I wanted to go with it as a memoir. So I said, okay. And part of their editing process involves helping smooth those transitions and making the timeline all work together. So there was a wonderful give and take of guidance with the publisher.
I find that really interesting that they're the ones who said, well, we see this as a memoir versus how you went into it initially, though. And of course, this spans throughout your life. And I want to bring up a part of your book that is you sitting with your mom and a nun of a school here in Milwaukee. So here's the quote. Mostly, though, I found emotions both dangerous and ineffective. Signs of anger, led to punishment and tears led to teasing. Better to keep my head down, withdraw inside, and embrace being, quote, stone. So I can see this approach not just in how you move through your family's dynamics as a young girl growing older, but also in the way your writing presents, like, plain details. You know, that's kind of your grounding way of approaching things. So you mentioned you kind of have written on and off, but did writing play a role in helping you remain stone and fill your pages with processing and emotions and be able to be stone face in the outer world and then be able to withdraw inside?
I would assume so. In the moment, I certainly didn't have that kind of wisdom available to me to see it that way. But I would assume that that was sort of a saving grace to kind of almost have that friend next to me that I could tell stuff to that I didn't trust anyone else with, even as a youngster. Although I think probably, let me see, at that age, I probably wasn't getting in depth in my journaling. It was probably more of a cataloging of events, but still it felt like a safe place to go.
With this book spanning throughout your life, of course, it brings the whole concept of memories, right? So did you struggle with memory in the sense of writing what may have, say, plainly happened if, like, an outside perspective was there versus the way you saw it or process it according to your age or because of approaching it as a writer and wanting to remember certain details or creative ways of presenting these events?
Well, when you write creative nonfiction, you try to look at things in two ways. There's the situation that happened. The nun rips up my book. But there's also the story and the meaning that you understand as you age and develop a greater understanding of everything. And so when you're writing creative nonfiction, I think you try to bring all that to bear. So there's that incident with the nun, but there's also my understanding of she was a person and who knows what was going on for her. And also in looking at the bigger picture of myself and my desire to not create a problem that'll get me more attention and more teasing in my life. So there's that dual perspective that I think is very, very important. In terms of the memories, I tried very hard to really be very strict with this really happened and not add something creative to that. Or, you know, there are plenty of wonderful nonfiction writers who are really okay with making a composite character of two or three people. And I never did that. That just doesn't fit for me. So the things that are presented are to the best of my ability, truly what happened. There are plenty of places in the memoir where I talk about I assume or I imagine. And that's what I do with the areas where I'm not so sure.
This book goes through a lot of things and harrowing events like family abandonment, an alcoholic mother who also dealt with depression, anxiety, drug abuse, and the trauma of being raised under these circumstances. So how did you immerse yourself in constantly, I'm sure, editing these pieces, going through them over and over, writing them in the first place? How do you do that and then take care of yourself?
Oh, that's another wonderful question. I think when you do the first couple drafts is when the emotion really comes up. So to sit and let that play out and see where you feel it in your body, and maybe that also needs to be added to the narrative, is the first place to go. Secondly, is to get outside for lots of walks. And I think for me, that maybe opposite thing of, you know, when you're writing, you're really closed in a space and inside your head. But then to do the opposite of self-care, which for me is getting outside and moving and working that through. Some of these essays have really been in play for up to 8 years. So by time I'm doing the editing that happened over the last year, it doesn't have an emotional feel, or very rarely has an emotional feel. It's more a piece I'm really trying to work on and shape in word choice and detail choice to the best of my ability.
With some of those times ranging up to 8 years through writing, editing, continuously changing how you present these essays, did that change your relationship with how you viewed these people or events previously?
It did. And I think that was wonderful about the process from Vine Leaves Press, and that one of their editing levels is kind of this big picture level. So that editor would say things like, you know, in that essay about keys, if you took the last third of that and added it to the essay here about riptides, that might be really cool. And my first thought would be, you know, my babies, how can you move those words? But of course, I was part of this process, so I'd give it a try. And then I'd be like, boy, that fits, that works there. So some of that was being willing to play with those words and move them around. And there was, during that stage, I had printed out the, I don't know, 160 pages or whatever. And I had them spread out across two rooms of my house because I needed the visual of seeing what it looked like if you moved words over here and how that felt. And so mostly it was a good experience, but I think there's no way I could, as a writer, deal with material that was very fresh. It would just be too much of feeling like your darlings you were killing. But at this point, I was at least willing to try the experiment. And in terms of how this affected my relationship with the characters, something that surprised me, because as I had said, there wasn't, you know, a lot of emotional reactions at this point. But something that surprised me is one of the pieces I was moving around and then writing a little bit where there was, there needed to be some more information about my dad. So I was trying to write something. And I felt like I learned a brand new thing that, like, it had never occurred to me to think about what was it like for him to come and pick up this sullen teenager who, you know, his ex-wife didn't want him to be around. And yet he kept doing it. And it was in a late stage of editing that I finally really thought about what that must have been like for him. So there's an example of when it changed my relationship to characters.
Right, seeing them down the road. Oh, they're people too, you know?
Yeah, who knew?
Well, in the title, this didn't really occur to me until I was just about to hop on this call with you, but This Is How We Leave. Do you see that as like your family legacy or theme, or what does it mean to you? What is the title?
Yeah. Way back, when this was a collection of essays, long before I sent it to this publisher, I had titled the book the same title as one of the essays, If Not for the Mess. And I really like that title. But one time, a very kind person who rejected it sent me a really nice letter about needing to find more of a theme that wove through. And when I read his letter, it's almost like I had this aha about how much leaving is in this book. And that's when the new title came to me. And it really cemented things for me as I started to look at you know, these generations of men leaving, but also the other ways that I leave, like by clamming up, you know, and not saying something, or by reading as much as I do, especially as a kid. I just totally left any bad situation through literature, which, you know, is maybe better than drugs, but of course it is. But it's another way of leaving. So sometimes we leave in really positive ways. Sometimes we lead by just daydreaming a lot.
Well, and to have this collection of This Is How We Leave now be able to be shared with so many people, you are inviting people to into your life. And I want to bring up another quote. And this was during an essay when you were reflecting on when your mother's health was declining and she was being moved from a hospital to a care facility. And you were trying to keep all this from your husband and your daughters. And you said, quote, "I wanted this drama kept separate from my husband and children, from my life." So your essays indeed share the same sentiment as you come into yourself throughout the years. So how do you feel literally putting your drama on a page in a book plainly for your family and for people you don't even know to see and invite them into your life?
Yes, that I think it's the distance and the timeline that allows that. At the time of writing that and feeling that when we were living it, I was so angry that it was taking the time from my current family and putting on them something I had to give up some childhood for. So somehow it doesn't bother me as much to have it happen later, and they've read this before. I think they've all read the book beforehand, so they were not surprised by things.
So has this book sparked more conversations with your family and particularly with your daughters?
Yes, it has, because even though they had read it before, I think they read it with a different eye. You know, especially I had asked both my daughters in final edits, I said, "Will you just read this and try to catch small errors, you know, spellings or a period or whatever?" And so I think that had them looking at it with a different eye also. And so it did, there was questions they would say like, "Boy, I didn't really realize that it was that bad with grandma," or, you know, just another memory that they then kind of wanted to explore.
What do you want people to feel or take away from sharing and reading your story, your family's stories?
Well, if I could sum it up in one word, I think it would be resiliency. And I think what I would like people to take away is that there are a lot of ways to turn out and to get through hard times and come out positive and use that past to help others. So I hope it would lend hope and help people find their own ways to be resilient during difficult times.
Well, Joanne, it's certainly a great collection, and I thank you for your work on it and for talking with me about it today.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to get to chat with you.
Lake Effect contributor Joanne Nelson lives in Heartland, Wisconsin, and she's the author of This Is How We Leave, which is out now. You can also explore her other essays at WUWM.com. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.